back in February 15th, there was a meteorite that exploded and impacted over Russia, which caused quite a bit of excitement, a lot of videos showing it streaking across the sky and blowing up. And then 5 days later, there was a meteor that streaked across the sky in Florida. And so this has increased public attention to the fact that things like this go through the atmosphere and sometimes hit the ground. Were these events in any way unusual?
The one over Russia was unusual in the scale of the event. They do happen frequently, but this is one typical of once every 100 years or so. The previous one that fit into this category was an explosion over the Tunguska region, also in Russia, and that was back in the year 1908.
Russia perhaps gets more than its share of these because it's so large.
Russia is a very large country, but it's just a matter of chance. You might think of it as two lottery tickets paying off.
Going much further back into time, there's evidence that much larger objects have impacted the Earth. There's the crater in the desert southwest in the United States and some other places. So, relatively speaking, this Russian event was pretty minor.
Yes, the meteorite that crashed into the Arizona desert would have been an iron meteorite, probably about the size of a 747 jet aircraft. The one that crashed in Russia was maybe a third that large, but it wasn't an iron meteorite, it was a stony one. So it was going to fragment into smaller pieces more easily.
And what is the fallout, if you will, of a large iron object like that hitting other than making a big hole in the ground?
What happens is it has a huge amount of energy. The energy comes more from the velocity as it's entering the Earth's atmosphere than it is from the mass of the object. So even though we've got an object double the size, it all depends on how fast it's moving as it's the Earth.
Yeah, but these are moving very fast, though.
Right. When it hit the top of the atmosphere, the one that went over Russia was moving about 40,000 miles per hour. And it streaked across the sky for about 30 seconds, decelerating all that time, but building up enough heat to make it glow as bright as the sun and eventually blow itself apart.
A very large impact is often thought to have been the ultimate demise of the dinosaurs, and so people are worried that, you know, should a really very large object come towards the Earth and impact that it could make us extinct, for example. Is that possible?
That is a possibility, but that's a very large object that brought the dinosaurs to their end. The object would have measured more than a kilometer across, and asteroid searches are being done right now where they're looking for these objects that have passed that bring them close to the Earth. They're called near Earth asteroid searches. And they're typically finding small ones now. The number of large ones, kilometer-sized ones that they found is about 1,000, and they think that that number is stable. But the searches that they're running right now, they're looking for things that are much smaller, and they're finding about 1,000 of those every year.
And we recently had an asteroid fly between the Earth and the Moon, I believe.
Yeah, there was an asteroid not just between the Earth and the Moon, but actually came within the orbits of the geosynchronous satellites that we've launched to carry out communications.
And what would have happened if it had actually hit the Earth?
That one would have been about twice the size of the object that blew up over Russia, and it would have had more energy. It would have been a larger explosion, and it all depends on how fast it was moving as it came into the atmosphere, the direction, and how high above the surface it exploded.
There have been calls in the wake of the Russian incident to step up the tracking of these objects that you've mentioned. But if we do have a tracking system, I guess that implies that if you find one and it's going to be a problem, there's something you can do about it, is there?
Right now, there's only kind of blue sky planning about what to do if we ever find one that's tracking toward us. It may be a while before we have the technology to actually protect ourselves from a large object that's hurtling at us from space. On the other hand, the more we find of them and the more prepared we are, the better we can make the plans for what we'd have to do in the future.
But it's probably not going to be Bruce Willis and a group of oil drillers blasting off in a resurrected space shuttle, for example.
That's pretty unlikely. There are ideas that range from putting small rockets on them to just nudge them a little bit away so they miss, to having just a coating placed on them to cause sunlight to change the energy that they have to nudge them a little farther out into space. These are things that will work if you catch it far enough away.
As we mentioned earlier, some pieces of this Russian meteorite did fall to Earth and were recovered. Is there something that scientists can learn from examining the remains of something like that?
Well, what they're finding about this one is that it's stony composition with a little bit of iron inside of it, typical of the asteroid belt objects. What we learn from studying these things is more about how the planets were put together at the beginning of the solar system.
They also, I believe, become rather pricey collector's objects sometimes, don't they?
Yeah, it depends on how much of the material there is and what condition it's in, depending on where the asteroid came from as well, or where the object of the meteorite came from. There are lunar meteorites, there are Martian meteorites, there's even believed to be a little piece of the planet Mercury that's fallen to the Earth's surface now.
This last month or so has been rather busy in astronomical terms. So maybe since we have you on the line, we'll ask about a couple other things. One is a comet, which may be coming into view here in March, Comet Pan-STARRS. That's kind of an odd name for a comet. How did it acquire that moniker?
Okay, the name Pan-STARRS actually comes from one of the asteroid search programs. That's the name of a telescope that's in Haleakala Crater on Maui, Hawaii. And they discovered the comet about a year and a half ago, and it's been moving gradually toward the inner solar system and getting brighter. Observers down in the southern hemisphere have been following it in the sky for the past few weeks. It has brightened up to the point where it's visible with a pair of binoculars. And about the second week of March, it's going to peak over our horizon in the evening sky. It's going to be low in the sky most of the time that it's there, but it could be as bright as the stars in the Big Dipper or the Belt of Orion.
I gather that bigger things were expected of this comet, so it's been something of a disappointment, apparently, in terms of brightness at least.
Right. There were predictions that it would be as bright as the planet Venus, and that leads us to a common statement about comets. Comets are like cats. They do what they damn well please. So the comet is going to brighten in a way that is completely unpredictable. On the other hand, there's a second comet that's coming toward the end of the year. Its name is ISON, and that one is expected to be a very bright comet because it's going to be very close to the sun as it rounds through the inner solar system.
Is that what determines the brightness of a comet, its orbit and how close it does get to the sun?
The orbit, how close it gets to the sun, how close it is to the Earth as it passes through the inner solar system, as well as the composition of the materials that are making up the comet. So if it's a fresh comet that hasn't been exposed to sunlight before, that material will begin evaporating off. And as it gets closer to the sun, more and more of it evaporates off the surface, forming the tail behind the comet. This one, the early predictions were it could be as bright as a full moon, but it will be right next to the sun at that point in time. So it's more likely to be a bright object in the evening sky again toward November. How bright it is has yet to be seen.
If it does turn out to be reasonably bright, though, since it's going to be close to the sun, it should be fairly easy to find, I would expect.
That's right. And there's actually a day when the comet Pan-STARRS is going to be fairly easy to find. Even if it's not real bright, it's going to be next to the moon on the night of March 12th. So if you can go outside and find the thin crescent moon that night, just look off a little bit to the left and you might be able to pick up the comet easily with a pair of binoculars.
The other astronomical news recently has been the discovery of another exoplanet, a planet circling another star, and these get announced all the time, except this one apparently sets the record for being small, in fact, so small it's only about the size of Earth's moon. Why does that make it special?
It means that the sensitivity of the equipment that they're using to detect these things can actually reach down and find Earth-sized planets, which is really one of the goals of the searches. They're looking for an Earth-sized planet in the habitable zone around a star. For different stars, the area where it's not too hot and not too cold varies. But if you can find a planet about Earth size that's within that band around the star, then you've got the possibility of a place where there could be life elsewhere in the universe.
Fairly recently, someone came up with an estimate that there were billions, with a B, of these planets about the size of Earth in the habitable zone in the Milky Way, our galaxy. Do you think that's a pretty fair estimate?
I think it's a pretty good estimate based on what they've been finding. When they started the searches, they were finding the big planets, and as time has gone by, they've been finding the medium-sized planets, and they found out that there are more of medium-sized planets than there are of big planets, and now they're starting to detect little planets. And I would imagine it's like other things that astronomers have thought, that as the sensitivity picks up, they'll find out that the smaller things are probably more dominant than the larger things.
The big exoplanets, you know, on the size of Jupiter or even larger, are still too small really to see directly. So how do you detect and determine how large these objects are?
The method that astronomers use is to look for what's called an occultation. When the object passes between the star and the Earth, it makes the starlight dim down just the tiniest little bit. But they have detectors on a spacecraft called Kepler, which is pointed at an area of the sky near the constellation Cygnus the Swan, which is visible in our summer sky. And it's monitoring thousands of stars all at the same time. It's doing measurements on them every few hours, and it looks for that little dimming in the brightness of the star. When it's picked up, then it's referred to a larger telescope for further observation.
Do you think this has any implications for what's usually referred to as SETI, or the search for extraterrestrial intelligence?
It is one of the figures that drops into what's called the Drake equation. And the Drake equation is basically a probability estimate for how many other worlds could be out there that could have civilizations that could communicate with us. The first term of the equation is the number of stars, or the rate of star formation within the galaxy. The second one is the number of those stars that have planets. And now we're beginning to discover that lots of stars have planets. The third one is the number of those planets that are in the habitable zone around the star. And we're beginning to find some of those planets. So we are getting to the point where we can begin to fill in some of the numbers of this Drake equation. There are other factors in it that we don't have any way of identifying right now. One of them is, how likely is it for life to form on one of those planets inside the habitable zone? Beyond that, how likely is it for it to develop intelligent life? And beyond that, how likely is it that they would develop the technology with which they could communicate with us?
And perhaps a further limitation is how long that civilization would last.
That's correct. If they live in a solar system anything like ours, they deal with the same kind of hazards we deal with. The lifetime that dinosaurs were on the Earth was from about 250 million years ago to about 65 million years ago, and it came to an end.
So they were here a lot longer than we have been so far.
That's correct.
One other astronomical bit of news that perhaps is worth mentioning is that a new moon, if that's the right term, for the former planet Pluto, which was recently demoted, has been discovered and was named Vulcan after the planet that Mr. Spock comes from. I guess that perhaps raises the question of how, when you discover a new astronomical body, how does it acquire a name?
The first name is usually given to it just as a year and a number to identify when it was discovered, and then it would include information on who discovered it. Then it goes to the International Astronomical Union, and they're the body that formally assigns names to the planets and to stars and to asteroids and all the other astronomical objects. They have guidelines for choosing names. For example, with the planet Uranus, the names of many of the moons of that planet are for Shakespearean characters. Or if you talk about the surface features on the planet Venus, because Venus was a goddess, all of the features on planet Venus are named for women, with one exception.
Yeah, what's the exception?
The exception is the Maxwell Mountains, which were named for James Clerk Maxwell, who basically formed the ideas behind electromagnetic radiation, which was used to penetrate the clouds of Venus to be able to see these features for the first time.
And most of the names that you mentioned are relatively serious, either figures from literature or mythology or science. But occasionally something a bit more whimsical, like Vulcan, for example, comes along. So the IAU does apparently have a sense of humor.
Yeah, and that's not the first Vulcan in our solar system. There was at one time the belief that there was a planet inside the orbit of Mercury. And there were a number of searches for it. The astronomer Le Verrier, who was a French astronomer, actually gave the planet the name Vulcan. And after years of trying to confirm that it existed, it was never found again. It had disappeared, and its name disappeared along with it for a while.
Eric Schreer is the coordinator of the planetarium at the Kalamazoo Valley Museum. Thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you.